This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
These are people who earn these benefits. That's why they came on the job as a public servant, knowing that they're going to get this Medicare. They paid into it. And now their union leaders have surrendered their benefits. They don't even have a voice.
Top union leaders are secretly conspiring with the insurance industry to privatize Medicare by pushing workers and retirees into Medicare Advantage.
These are organizations across Africa, France, the U.S. and Canada coming together to defend African Dream, and we have to be able to battle it out on the main street where everybody else is hanging out.
Activists organize a petition to address a McCarthy-like attack on African Stream, a Pan-African news outlet.
And then we started wondering, how could a drug ring of this size operate for this long in the midst of the war on drugs without anybody ever busting them?
December 10th marked the 20th anniversary of the suspicious death of investigative journalist Gary Webb, who uncovered and extensively documented the U.S. government's role in fueling the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s and 1990s. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. The murder of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York City on December 4th has led to a massive outpouring of anger against the insurance industry for its common practice of denials and delays of healthcare claims. A TikTok content creator and self-described insurance worker talked about how the insurance industry has been behind the efforts to privatize Medicare.
I'm going to talk about United Healthcare. I am not going to talk about what happened to their CEO yesterday because I can't be honest about how I feel about it. And if I can't be honest, then I'm just not going to talk about it. But I'm going to give you some facts about it because I work with insurance and people should know. People should know these things. So United Healthcare, they own Optum Health. They own Change Healthcare. There's 158 subsidiaries underneath of United Healthcare, some of which are overseas, and most of those are pharmaceutical services. So yes, they also are part of Big Pharma. So now they're insurance, Big Pharma, Change Healthcare. If you don't know what that is the service that processes the claims from the provider to the insurance company so the provider can get the pittance of money that the insurance company is going to pay them for their services that have been rendered. Earlier this year, Change Healthcare got hacked. It's almost been a year now. They still aren't completely back up and running. So when this happened, United Healthcare, I know y'all think doctors sit on piles of cash. That's not how it works. They have to be getting the insurance money in on a regular basis to keep their money flow going. Well, when you can't send your claims in because Change Healthcare has been hacked and you can't mail it in and you have to go around all these, the doctors weren't getting paid. Their bank accounts were empty. So a lot of them were going under. So United Healthcare went out and was like, hey, we can help you out. We're going to buy. We'll buy your practice, your hospital, your urgent care. And they went and they bought them. So now they're insurance. Now they're pharmaceutical. Now they own the system that processes the claims. Now they own the providers that use their insurance. The providers are owned by United Healthcare and getting paid from United Healthcare, from United Healthcare claims. You know they're already in trouble with the DOJ already because of all of this. Like if this is not a monopoly, I don't know what is. So in 2023, their total revenue was $371.6 billion, 14.6% increase from 2022, and $22.4 billion in profit in 2023. They paid out $281.4 billion in claims in 2023. But let me tell you this. United Healthcare is the main insurance for Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare plans. That is the main, is 29% enrollment is United Healthcare under those three things. Those are all government-run healthcare systems. And United Healthcare is the main insurer for all of them. I don't know about you, but when a company decides to become that big, that they are now the doctor, they're the provider, they're the insurance company, they're the pharmaceutical company, they're the company that processes their own claims. They did a study, and United Healthcare, by a 90% margin, denied more claims than any other insurance company on the market. And again, they are the highest enrollment for all of the government-run healthcare, Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare. They deny. And then people die.
That was a TikTok content creator talking about how United Healthcare has captured Medicare. Labor journalist Joe Masicalo of WorkBytes spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about top union leaders who have secretly conspired to push the privatization of Medicare by pushing workers and retirees into Medicare Advantage.
The first thing to realize is that the city of New York has been covering its employees' Medicare for like 60 years. It's one of the reasons why people are always told, yeah, do what you want to do, but always have a fallback, always have a good city job. That's what made a good city job, is that you would know that once you retire, you would have medical coverage. You know, the city would pick up that 20% of Medicare was never designed to cover, right? But since like 2014, in the aftermath of the Bloomberg years, when none of the union contracts were settled and nobody got a raise, they hatched this scheme under former Mayor de Blasio to save the city $600 million a year in Medicare costs by pushing everybody into Medicare Advantage, taking the responsibility, you know, off the city, giving it to the private companies, and then everybody, you know, would get a raise. You know, UFT teachers mostly would get a raise. So that's how this whole thing started.
So they basically, for a wage increase, the city union said, let's basically lower the standards or the benefits of the retirees.
Yeah, to surrender that Medicare benefit that, right, remember, right, 1965 when it came in, how did it happen? With labor support, pushed it over the top, made it a reality. Now, fast forward to today, and that's out the window. Nobody ever thinks about that anymore. All I hear is like, this is the way of the world, Joe. We have to deal with these insurance companies.
And so when members began to find out about it, because apparently it was kept a secret from the members and the retirees, how did that happen?
It was just retirees, like the most vulnerable, but the most courageous people ever, just getting together, organizing. Because who did they do this to? They did this to lifelong trade unionists. So they knew how to organize. And that's what they did. They organized into organizations, and for the last 3.5 years, they've been fighting on the streets, in the halls of power, in the court. One organization that's been leading the fight in the courts is the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees. They've won positive rulings in their favor 10 times in a row. And yet, you still have the mayor of the city trying to push it with the support of the heads of the big public service sector unions.
And these union officials, why don't you talk about them? Because apparently they even put a retirees chapter, AFSCME, in trusteeship, which had been supporting a campaign to defend their healthcare benefits.
They raided their offices, Steve, in February. AFSCME raided the retiree organization offices in February and took it over. And that was, they'll say differently, but that's a direct result of the retiree association backing the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees and in their fight against the privatization push.
And of course, members did not know about it. And one of the unions you recently covered, the Transport Workers Union, where the president apparently is denying that this actually is an attack on their members.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he just pushed everybody at the beginning of this year that went into effect. So he's still gaslighting everybody, telling everybody that Medicare Advantage is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's an enhancement of benefits. Great if you don't really want to use your health care. But now, especially out-of-state transit workers, retired and gone to Arizona or other places, they find out oh, I can't even use this. I can't use this to get the care that I need. I can't get the operation that my wife needs. Or I have to be put through this stress and turmoil of waiting, you know, going through all these prior authorizations. And ultimately, you could get denied.
And also, one of the unions in the public employees group in New York is the Teamsters. Apparently, the Teamsters head in New York was on a board, an insurance board that was there. I mean, that they're insurance boards that these officials are part of.
Yeah, I know the person you're talking about. I don't remember which of the insurance companies now, but yeah, that's also true. But then, like, you know, we're talking about transit workers, right? You have another union that represents supervisors, basically, across all the titles in the transit system. And he says categorically, you're not getting our Medicare MTA. I don't care what the other union did, but I don't. It's very emotional and personal for him. He's very, very passionate about it. It's like, not only am I not giving it up at the bargaining table, but we're going to change our bylaws to make sure that anybody that comes in after me is not going to be able to give it away. And he's like, you know, I don't have any respect for these union leaders that have done this. They shouldn't be union leaders, is what he tells me.
And this Medicare Advantage, isn't it the case that the AFL-CIO national unions are actually advertising Medicare Advantage on their websites, have contracts with these insurance companies, Anthem and others, for Medicare Advantage, and basically getting money for the unions from privatization of Medicare?
Yeah, that's part of it too. Let's rewind before the SAG-AFTRA went on strike. Medical was a major problem for that union. That's what caused the schism. And what happened as a result of that? They unrolled their own Medicare Advantage plan, putting all their members, you know, into Medicare Advantage.
And so they ended up with cuts.
So they ended up with this great Medicare Advantage plan that's subject to prior authorization, delays, denials, and a ever dwindling pool of participating doctors and hospitals.
And the Democrats, who were in the majority, allowed for Medicare Advantage. They said it was going to cover services and other things that were not covered by Medicare. You think that was really a sham argument to push privatization of Medicare?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, people really are ardent about Medicare for All, enhancing Medicare, you know, and that's pie in the sky at this stage still. But and yet this, to privatize everything, that's just taken as a matter of course.
And of course, the assassination of the head of United Healthcare has opened up a lot of investigation of United Healthcare and the fact that it's a vertically organized company that controls the doctors, controls the service providers, controls the payers, controls drug companies, that they control the largest part of Medicare is done now through United Healthcare. And they're making billions of dollars, as well as other providers for Medicare. Where do you think this is going? Because it seems like these companies really want to completely destroy and privatize Medicare. And that's what's happening in front of our faces. And it doesn't seem to be an issue within the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, or any of these unions.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to happen. If people don't become aware that it's happening and decide to follow the New York City retirees' example, get up, get out into the street and organize against it, it's going to happen.
And one of the issues of healthcare, a lot of unions are that is fighting around that issue of healthcare. And a lot of their gains, wages, go to healthcare companies. And this has become a national issue because the companies now are saying, you have to go into our privatized healthcare plans that we run, not the union-run plans. You think that's going to threaten the whole union structure of healthcare in the United States? Because a lot of unions have said they should join the union because they're going to get healthcare. But if everybody's in a Medicare Advantage plan or a privatized plan, what difference does it make?
Absolutely. I mean, that's another point that we brought out in the very beginning, and retiree stress is like, this undermines the labor movement. This, no one is going to want to join a union if they know that they don't have good coverage, that they're forced into this crappy plan, either when they're an active worker or when it comes to retire. That's the most galling thing. It's like, these are people who earn these benefits. That's why they came on the job as a public servant. knowing that they're going to get this Medicare. They paid into it. And now they turn around and their union leaders have surrendered their benefits. They don't even have a voice.
That was labor journalist Joe Masicalo of Work Bites speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Do you all know fake news? Do you know fake news? Do you know fake news, man? Everywhere I go in Europe for the last 2 years and America, everybody's crazy about this shit. Everybody's losing their goddamn minds. Fake news, fake news, fake news. Fake news. Relax, everybody. Take it easy. Calm down, man. You see, in the motherland where I'm from, we have been under fake news for 400 years, man. Welcome to the party. Yeah. This is Sheu Anukulagokuti reporting live from Lagos, Nigeria, West Africa, for the Black Times, everybody.
That was Sheun Kuti, Black Times. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. On September 13th, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken held a press conference accusing the Russian media outlet RT of covertly spreading Kremlin propaganda targeting audiences not only in the United States, but also in Africa and beyond. Blinken specifically called out AfricanStream, a pan-African media platform distributed through its website, AfricanStream.media, and various social media channels. Shortly after Blinken's remarks, AfricanStream was banned on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, likely under pressure from the State Department. Block Report's J.R. Valray spoke to Julie Varughese, the output editor for AfricanStream. Varughese and others are organizing a petition to address the McCarthy-like attack on AfricanStream.
What is AfricanStream? How long has it been around, and who funds it?
AfricanStream is a pan-Africanist, anti-imperialist digital outlet. It puts out news 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It started in Nairobi, Kenya. It's currently based there as well. And it grew all of its platforms to 2.5 million subscribers as of September, mid-September. And it is privately funded.
What kinds of stories does AfricanStream cover?
We cover the news that Africans would be interested in, but from the perspective of pan-Africanism and anti-imperialism, which is not present at all in the mainstream media. Although it's present in alternative media spaces, it's not that obvious because there aren't that many African-oriented platforms that are also very popular and cover the news from the pan-Africanist and anti-imperialist perspective that we do.
When you cover, say, genocides like the genocide in Sudan that you guys have covered, or the genocide in the Congo, or what's going on in Haiti, what is the difference in the way that you cover those stories and the way that the Western media covers those stories for people who don't understand, say, the political jargon that you've been using?
First of all, we operate like a regular news outlet in that we don't use jargon. And when we do, we break it down for people. Any kind of abbreviations, any kind of technical or political verbiage, we kind of explain it in a way that anybody could understand it. And the way that we cover the situation in Sudan, the situation in Gaza, and et cetera, Congo, all these things across the continent. It's done as news by Africans for Africans, but from a Pan-Africanist and anti-imperialist perspective, and speaking to our viewers and our readers like they're at our same level. We've been covering Sudan a lot more than typical mainstream media outlets, way more than any of them across the board. And compared to alternative outlets, the difference has been that we simply have a larger reach and therefore more people can see it. Same thing when we cover the Congo, we've done a lot of stories about the impact of mineral mining on the children there who are being used, the lawsuit that failed, the connections between the Congo mining and Israel, Israeli business people, and the U.S., and what all those connections are, and also the connections between the mining and the war going on in Congo, and the displacements, and Rwanda and Uganda's role as neighbors to the Congo. And so we've just been regularly covering it, which is something that you don't see in other media outlets.
Can you tell us, when was African Stream removed from these different platforms? What platforms was African Stream taken off of? And what was the process in which was taken to remove African Stream from various platforms?
Yeah, so on September 13th, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken did a press briefing where he announced that African Stream is secretly run by the Russian state media TV network RT, and that we showcase Kremlin propagandists. A few days later, YouTube banned our account or suspended our account, and then came Meta, which is the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and WhatsApp. And then a week later, actually still in that same week, we were removed from using Stripe, which is the payment processing application that we were using on Twitter to be able to generate revenue, advertising revenue on Twitter. So we lost out on that revenue on Twitter, even though we remained on Twitter. And then following week, we were permanently banned from TikTok. The week after that, we were suspended from Google, which means that we cannot access our Gmail accounts, our Google Drives, etc. And so we relate to all this as being part of the long line, century-old narrative that's been played against Africans in the U.S. and around the world, which is that anybody who fights for their freedom is automatically deemed a communist or Soviet-linked or Russian-backed. It goes back, like I said, a century back, and that narrative is still in play. It just has different names, different ways that it shows up, but the idea is the same, that Africans, whether they're in the U.S. or around the world, they shouldn't be fighting for their freedom. And if they do, this is the consequence, that you may not necessarily be killed, but you definitely can encounter some smearing, which can prevent you from getting jobs or prevent you from living in the place that you've been living in, just making your life a bit miserable in some way or another. And so the whole McCarthyist kind of witch hunt that was going on in the early to mid 20th century, that actually, Africans in the U.S. were the first to be attacked by it and the first to be smeared by it as communists, even if they were not communists. Just fighting for your freedom is enough to get smeared as a communist. And that, as I mentioned, brings all these consequences with it, which it makes it just worse for people who are oppressed within the United States. And similarly, in the mid-20th century, the U.S. government was smearing African leaders on the continent like Kwame Nkrumah, calling many of them Soviet-linked or communists, when all they were doing, not all that they were doing, but, you know, what they were really doing was trying to help liberate their own people, bring a sense of self-determination to their processes in their individual countries after flag independence in the mid-20th century. And so anybody, even those leaders, the simple fact that they're trying to bring about something different that opposes, not even opposes, but is simply different from, is juxtaposed to Western imperialism, that automatically gets you smeared as a communist and puts you in their crosshairs, where then you may get assassinated, you may get ousted, as a leader and get replaced by a Western-backed leader. Your country may face economic sanctions, which can make life miserable. It's still happening to this day with a lot of countries. If a country is not abiding by bowing down to the United States, for example, they can suffer these economic sanctions that actually make life miserable for the ordinary people in the country, denying them access to food and medicines and fuel. The idea, which a lot of people say who are experts and really study this, they say that the idea behind economic sanctions is to, like in the case of Chile, was to make the economy scream. So that's the same thing when the U.S. imposes economic sanctions on other countries, including in Africa.
Similar to places like Zimbabwe, who they have sanctions on right now. Your answer kind of bled into my next question. Similar to what you just mentioned, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken spoke publicly about a number of media organs working with the Russians to influence people in the U.S. And Democratic Party war criminal Hillary Clinton recently spoke on the need for more federal mandated fact checking, which is basically the creation of a quote unquote information police department that will be more intrusive than the current FBI's counterintelligence program, which is still holding Black Panther author and award winning broadcast journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal captive after 43 years. Why is it important for us to maintain our own voice?
That's a good question. The fact is that Africans and other marginalized peoples in the United States don't enjoy the same freedom of speech that is enshrined in the Constitution. And similarly, just any kind of freedom or right, human right, it's not guaranteed in the United States because Africans in the United States, like indigenous people, are a domestic colony inside the United States. And so there's no real power that African people have inside the United States. And so since the First Amendment is not accessible, it's not an insured or a guaranteed right. Therefore, it's absolutely necessary when you're a marginalized population to have your own media vehicles, your own way to communicate with each other and within the community. And so these kind of vehicles, these news outlets like African Stream are so important for that reason because we speak directly to Africans. It's from Africans to Africans. African Stream is an African-led operation, an African-led news operation. And all of our staff who are on camera doing the reports are all Africans. That makes a big difference because the people who are writing our stories, there's like a cultural knowledge that's there compared to if you just, you know, anybody can report on Africa, but there are a lot of nuances there that you just won't have if you're not from within the community. And so it's very important to have access to these vehicles that are independent, independently funded media outlets, because if you're from within an oppressed community like Africans, forget about representation. You're just not going to hear the truth about your community, period. And you're going to be even propagandized like we see over the past several decades from the mainstream media. The idea of being an American, the idea of Africans striving to be Americans, or the idea of Africans striving for the American dream, Black radicals will say that it's actually nonsensical because Africans are a colony within the United States to this day, you know, with incarceration rates much higher than the percentage of the population. It's about 37% of Black people that are in prison compared to making up 13% of the whole population of the U.S. And so things like that show that, as well as health outcomes and everything else, shows that there is no power for Africans within the United States. And that's why media outlets that are independently funded like African Stream are so necessary.
What is it that people are doing to support African Stream?
So African Stream is still operating. It's on Twitter at this point, Twitter, Telegram, Rumble, and Patreon, still operating as a news operation, but it's kind of just doing its thing. It's continuing to be a news operation. The public, though, has risen up and formed a coalition to defend African Stream. It's been put together by 8 organizations, some of which your people may know, like Friends of the Congo, the Center for Research on the Congo, West Africa Weekly, which is an independent news outlet based out of West Africa, Voices with Vision, which is a radio program on a Pacifica radio station in Washington, D.C., and it's called the Coalition for the Elimination of Imperialism in Africa, as well as a group out of France, and they also have people in Africa. They're called Ligue de Défense Noir Africain, which translates to Black African Defense League. And so these are organizations across Africa, France, the U.S. and Canada, coming together to defend African Stream. And what that means materially is for now circulating a petition to get signatures to demand that the U.S. State Department retract its statements about African Stream from September 13th, calling African Stream secretly run by RT, as well as showcasing Kremlin propagandists. It's also demanding that Stanford University's Internet Observatory retract its September 17th analysis, which was based off of Anthony Blinken's false claims about African Stream, but did not use any evidence. And then also demanding that mainstream media outlets and any media outlet, some of which were like NBC, Voice of America, that they retract all of their stories and videos about African Stream, which misinformed the public. And finally, the final demand is that all the tech giants, so YouTube, Meta, which is the parent company for Facebook, Instagram, Threads, as well as TikTok and Google and Stripe, all reinstate African Stream's accounts. And the reason for that, it sounds a little bit dangerous to say, just reinstate it, because at any point, obviously, they could take it away again. But, you know, this is kind of like the battle that we're in as ordinary people, is that we have to be able to battle it out on the main street where everybody else is hanging out. And if we're on the side street on little platforms or independent platforms, no offense to them, the fact is that we're not reaching as many people. We're reaching the choir a lot of times, but we're not reaching the people who just don't know the information. Their minds could change if they were exposed to the information regularly. And so that's why it's important for independent media makers and everybody else to be on platforms like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, etc., because you want to be on Main Street where everybody else is able to see and hear your stuff or potentially be exposed to your stuff. That's really how we grew to be so big with 2.5 million subscribers. It's because of the fact that their algorithms of those platforms were really pushing us out there because we were making videos and they were just very consumable pieces of information. And so the petition is out there. You can find it at defendafricanstream.com/petition. You can sign the petition. When you do so, you become a member of the Coalition to Defend African Stream. And other actions that you can take include making a video of yourself defending African Stream to post on social media, using the hashtag #DefendAfricanStream, as well as you could use the hashtag that African Stream created back in September, which is #WeAreAllAfricanStream. And also, we have a bunch of logos. It's our logo, Coalition to Defend African Stream, but it's in English, French, and Spanish on our website, which is defendafricanstream.com/petition.
That was Julie Varughese, Output Editor for African Stream, speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio.
In Rochester, New York, by way of Atlanta, please give it up for our man, Suleiman.
I am not angry. I am anger. I am not dangerous. I am danger. I am abominable stress, idiotic, relentless. I'm a breath of vengeance. I'm a death sentence. I'm forsaken repentance to the beast and his henchmen, armed forces and policemen that survive off of oil and prisons of today. Cup one is over with lost souls that wear oversized caps like blindfolds, shiny necklaces like lassos, dragging them into black holes. And I may have to holler at Fidel Castro to get my other brothers out of Guantanamo. And the innocents on death row is probably in the same proportion as the criminals in black robes, that smack gavels, that crack domes, that smack gavels, that smash homes. Justice is somewhere in between reading sad poems and 40 ounces of gasoline crashing through windows. It is between plans and action. It is between writing letters to congressmen and clapping the captain. It is between raising legal defense funds and put a gun on the bailiff and taking the judge captive. It is between prayer and fasting, between burning and blasting. Freedom is between the mind and the soul, between a lock and the load, between the zeal of the young and the patience of the old. Freedom is between the finger and the trigger. It is between the page and the pen. It is between the grenade and the pen, between righteous anger and keeping one in the chamber. So what can they do with a cat with a heart like Turner, a mind like Douglas, a mouth like Malcolm, and a voice like Chris? That is why I am not dangerous, I am danger. I am not angry, I am anger. I am abominable stress, idiotic, relentless. I'm a death sentence to the beast and his henchmen, politicians and big businessmen. I'm a teenage Palestinian opening fire at an Israeli checkpoint, point blank, checkmate, now what? I'm a rape victim with a gun cocked to his cock, cock, bang, bang, cock, now what? I am Sitting Bull with Colonel Custer's scalp in my hands. I am Sin K with a slave traded blood on my hands. I am Jonathan Jackson handing a gun to my man. I am David with a slingshot and a rock. And if David lived today, he'd have a Molotov cocktail and a Glock. So down with Goliath, I say down with Goliath, but we must learn, no, write, read, we must kick, bite, yell, scream, we must pray, fast, live, dream, fight, kill, and die free.
That was Amir Suleiman, Danger. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. December 10th marked the 20th anniversary of the death of investigative journalist Gary Webb. Many believe that Webb was murdered because of his groundbreaking exposé, Dark Alliance, which was published in the San Jose Mercury News in 1997. Webb's report uncovered and extensively documented the U.S. government's role in fueling the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s and 1990s. According to Webb, the CIA created the epidemic in black neighborhoods in the Bay Area and Los Angeles to covertly fundraise to support the Nicaraguan Contras in their fight against the revolutionary Sandinistas in Nicaragua. The ensuing violence and devastation from the crack epidemic were later used to justify the mass incarceration of black and brown communities feeding the U.S. prison system. Next, we share excerpts from Donald Lacey's 2004 interview with Webb. It was recorded at downtown Oakland's Java House months before Webb's death.
The story came to me sort of in a roundabout way, which is the way stories usually come to reporters. I had been working on a series of articles about the drug war, and looking specifically at these asset forfeiture laws where they go in and take people's houses away from them and take people's cars away from them because they think they're a drug dealer. And I had done a series on that for the Mercury and had gotten the law abolished. And after that series came out, I had a call from a woman who lived here in Oakland, ironically, who said that her boyfriend had a similar situation. He was in jail. He'd been in jail for 3 years. And never been brought to trial. All of his assets, all of his houses, all of his businesses had been confiscated. And she thought that it might make a good follow-up story for what I was working on. And I said, well, you know, it might, but I'd already done this story a lot of times. And I didn't see anything new in what she had to say. You know, it was sad, but it was a fact of life in the drug war, you know. You don't have to be guilty to lose your property. And then she said, well, you know, there's something about this story that I'm sure that you haven't written about before. And you know, I said, what's that? And she said, well, one of the witnesses in this case used to work for the CIA, and he used to sell crack or cocaine in Los Angeles. And I said, wait a minute, he used to work for the CIA and he used to sell drugs? And she said, yeah, and I've got documents and I've got things to prove it. And I didn't believe her. And she said, well, I can prove it. Come over and take a look at it. So I drove over to Oakland and I met her, and she had a lot of documents that I don't know. I don't know what the federal government was thinking when they released these things to her, but there were grand jury transcripts and there were DEA reports and there were FBI reports about this drug ring that had existed here in the Bay Area and in L.A. For about 10 years during the 80s and 90s. And the grand jury testimony was that during the startup of this drug ring, they had been selling drugs to support the Contras, which is this Nicaraguan army that the CIA was supporting down in Central America.
During the Reagan administration.
During the Reagan, but yeah, this is all during the Reagan Bush administration. And the thing that struck me about it was that this grand jury transcript was the testimony of somebody who had been a drug dealer for a long time.
And this now, is Freeway Ricky?
No, this is the guy named Danilo Blandón, who was a Nicaraguan,
right,
who had come to the United States after the revolution in Nicaragua and had started selling drugs in L.A. And at the point in time where he was testifying before the grand jury, he was now working for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, if the government's putting this guy on the stand and he's saying this, they must believe it or they wouldn't have him up there testifying. So I went back to my editors and I said, I think we've got an interesting story here. Here we have a federal witness who's it's the police. We can't even talk about this.
They're not coming for you out of
here. I don't think so. We can't, you know, we've got a guy here who's working for the federal government saying he sold drugs to support the Contras, and I think this is a good story. And they agreed. I mean, it had been something that had been sort of rumored during the 80s, but nobody ever nailed it down, and so they turned me loose on it, which wasn't unusual. I mean, I had been an investigative reporter at that point for like 17 years, and I'd won a lot of awards, and I had written for the Mercury for 9 years, and they said, if you see a story, go after it. And so I started working on it. It took me like a year to finish it up, but that's how I got started.
So now, once you found this story, or this story found you, now Blandón, now what was Freeway Ricky's involvement? Was he the distributor for Blandón? Is that how that worked?
Yeah, I didn't know about Freeway Rick until about halfway through the story. I was concentrating on these Nicaraguans who were bringing the cocaine into the country, and it turned out that Freeway Rick was their customer. And I had some familiarity with Rick because when I was doing the asset forfeiture series, I had researched his case, and I knew from reading the L.A. Times stories and talking to cops that this guy was the biggest crack dealer in L.A. during the early 80s. And suddenly it occurred to me, well, if this guy was the biggest crack dealer in L.A. during the 80s and he was buying his cocaine from these Nicaraguan Contras, there's a bigger story here than I thought. And at that point, I went back to my editors and I said, look, I think this is a pretty big story now. And I think we need to go to Nicaragua. I think we need to go to Central America. And I think we need to go around the country to sort of tie up these loose ends and document this thing. Because, I mean, from what I knew about Rick and from what I knew about the quantities of cocaine that these Nicaraguans were bringing into the country, this was a huge, huge drug ring that had a major impact on South Central L.A., and had never been written about before. So,
our guest, it's a pleasure to have Mr. Gary Webb, of course, the author of Dark Alliance. So then when you went back to your editors and said, we've got a bigger story here, we need to go around to these various places and tie up these loose ends and see how this whole puzzle fits together, then what happened?
Well, I ended up down in Nicaragua interviewing a drug kingpin named Norwin Meneses, who was the head of this drug operation. He had been living here in San Francisco for a long time and running this drug ring out of a couple of houses in the Mission District in the Pacifica. And he was in jail in Nicaragua at the time. And we set up an interview with him and went down and talked to him. And he basically admitted that, yeah, he had been working with the Contras, that this was part of an effort to fund the Contras because Congress had cut off money for supporting them. And, you know, these men thought what they were doing was very patriotic. And frankly, a lot of Americans thought that the Contras were, well, Reagan described them as the, you know, moral equivalent of the Founding Fathers. So the idea that they were selling drugs was sort of, to them, just a way to justify, you know, the ends justify the means, that old saying.
Sure.
And they were using cocaine to sell here in the United States, and they used the money to buy weapons for the Contras, and trucks and uniforms and that sort of thing. So once we sort of completed the circle, you know, we had Blandón as the guy who was down in L.A. selling to Rick, and we had Meneses as the guy who was selling the drugs to Blandón and bringing him into the country. And then we started wondering, how could a drug ring of this size operate for this long in the midst of the war on drugs without anybody ever busting them?
Right.
And so that's what we decided to do next, was try to find out how. And what happened, we found out, was that they were being protected the whole time they were selling drugs, from the times that these planes left Colombia to the time they arrived in San Francisco. It was a protected operation. I mean, the FBI knew about it, and they weren't allowed to investigate it. The DEA knew about it. Specific agents found out about it. They weren't allowed to investigate it, or their investigations were compromised. The LA County Sheriff's Department found out about it, and they actually tried to do something about it, and their investigation was blown, and the officers believed it was blown by the CIA. Because at that point in time, if anybody had found out that the Contras were dealing coke, you know, it would have been the end of their public support in the United States. And the thing to me that made this so outrageous was that once this cocaine came into the country, it didn't just disappear, you know, and that's sort of where the trail ended in these previous investigations. And we tracked it back down to the street and found out that Rick's, three-way Rick's customers were the Crips and the Bloods, who were turning it into crack and selling it all through South Central and eventually through the United States. So when we put all this stuff together, we did a story that said this was the first major drug pipeline into South Central. This was the drug ring that fed the crack epidemic and basically caused it to explode in South Central. And that was in essence the three-day series that we did for the Mercury.
I want to get back to the complicity of the government and the CIA in particular, but it had to go further than the CIA. In other words, the CIA wasn't just operating as some lone independent wing without the Reagan administration. And then what was Oliver North's connection to this whole crack cocaine distribution and the Iran-Contra scandal?
Well, first of all, you know, the idea that the CIA is this rogue elephant agency that operates on its own is nonsense. I mean, they report directly to the president. And in during these years, William Casey was the head of the CIA. He was Reagan's former campaign manager. He was a friend of his. So Casey was basically the one that was in charge of this. Whether Reagan knew about it personally or not, I've never been able to tell. But William Casey certainly knew about it.
Sure.
And one of the things that came out after my series came out, thanks largely to Maxine Waters, was this document called a Memorandum of Understanding, which had been signed between the CIA and the Justice Department back in, I believe it was 1981 or 1982, right when this covert operation down in Nicaragua was starting. And what this memorandum said, very simply, it made one little change to the intelligence laws of this country, but what it said was, if a CIA agent or a CIA asset is believed to be or actually is involved in narcotics trafficking, they no longer have to notify the Justice Department about it. And that's all it did.
Wow.
So you tell me why they would sign a document like that that gives an exemption to CIA-related drug trafficking without knowing that something like that is about to happen. My impression was that they knew from the get-go that they were going to use cocaine money to fund this war. They knew from the get-go that they were going to use opium money to fund the war in Afghanistan, which was also breaking out right at this time. Remember the Mujahideen and our great buddies Osama bin Laden and those folks.
He was a good guy.
He was one of our buds allegedly, then. You know, well, just like Manuel Noriega, as another example of a CIA guy dealing drugs. Manuel Noriega was one of the prime offenders of that. So what this document told me, and along with the other documents I was able to gather, was that this was anticipated by the Reagan administration. It was a way to get around the funding ban that Congress had instituted on them when this whole thing became public and the American people said, why are we sending money to Nicaragua to support a bunch of dictators and thugs, which is what the Contras were, essentially.
Sure.
So Oliver North's involvement came about in a little different fashion. From 1981 till about 1985 or 84, the CIA ran the Contra program. After the Boland Amendment went into effect, which Congress said, no more CIA money, no more Department of Defense money is going to be used to fund this, CIA backed out, and Oliver North stepped in and ran the operation from that point on. Now, at the time that happened, there were two drug rings operating that were supporting the Contras. There was this one out here on the West Coast that I wrote about, and then there was an East Coast drug ring that was run by a Cuban name, or a Colombian named Jorge Morales. Ollie North knew about that East Coast drug connection. He facilitated the laundering of money that that drug ring was using by giving these companies that Morales and these other drug dealers were operating, they actually had State Department contracts. And they were using the bank accounts of these companies to launder some of this money through. And this is not anything that I discovered. I mean, this is public record. This came out during the 80s when John Kerry did his hearings on contra drug trafficking, which everybody said, oh, that's a bunch of nonsense. You know, right. It never happened. It's just a bunch of Sandinista propaganda. Well, North knew about it. And the reason we know this is because he wrote about this stuff in his diaries. He was getting memos from his CIA man down in Central America named Rob Owen, who was telling him, you know, the Contras are dealing drugs. We believe that these commanders are directly involved in drug trafficking. And then when my series came out and there was that big public outcry, the CIA did this internal investigation. And, you know, even though it was pretty much of a whitewash, even during a whitewash, something comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And what came out of that CIA investigation were some interviews that the agency had done with a Cuban that was working for North down in Costa Rica, and a man who had been the subject of a number of rumors that he was involved in a major drug trafficking operation. The CIA went to him and they said, we'd like to talk to you about your involvement in illegal narcotics trafficking. And what he said was, and you know, I've got the documents and I quoted them in the book, I can't talk about drug trafficking because of the things that I was doing for the National Security Council. I had had an ongoing relationship with them.
That's convenient.
Yeah, which makes it very, very difficult to talk to you about drug trafficking,
right,
vis-a-vis Oliver North. And this, and so instead of saying, what the hell is going on here? Why is this guy telling us he can't talk about drug trafficking because he's involved with the National Security Council? The CIA said, let's quit talking to him. We don't need to know what he needs to know. Or what he's got to tell us. We don't want to know, and they shut down the investigation.
Wow.
And that's where things stand to this day.
Now, you said a lot of things in that a few statements back in terms of the government looking the other way when the drugs come in the country. And I've always, which isn't news to me, because I've always maintained that somehow the government has been complicit in the drug trade, particularly cocaine and opium, from day one, by at the very least looking the other way, probably taking a payment in the back door and letting that happen. Is it fair to say that that still goes on today because it's still a mushrooming, burgeoning industry that this so-called war on drugs that started with the Reagan administration hasn't even begun to make a dent in terms of getting the drugs and the supply of drugs off the streets?
Well, I agree with you that the drug war has been like a total failure. If you look at it to the extent that it was designed to get drugs off the streets, it hasn't. Drugs are more plentiful than ever. They're cheaper than they ever were. If you look at it as a way to reduce our civil liberties, as a way to destroy search and seizure protections in the Constitution, it's been a roaring success.
Right.
And I think that was the motive behind the drug war all along. It wasn't to stop drugs.
I mean,
occasionally they might come up with a drug seizure and make it look good. I think it was an attempt to get around a lot of civil liberties problems that they had with the Constitution, rein in a lot of civil rights, and do it under the guise of protecting us, which, you know, if you want to look at modern-day parallels, the war on terrorism, I think, is the same deal.
Sure.
You look at the stuff in the USA Patriot Act, and it's identical in intent to what all these drug laws did. You know, gave the cops warrantless searches, gives them eavesdropping capabilities now they never had before. It allows them to lock people up without charges. So I think it's just one long continuation. It's a war on civil liberties more than anything.
That was journalist Gary Webb, author of The Dark Alliance, speaking to Donald Blasey of San Francisco's Radio 89.5 KPOO in 2004. For the link to the full interview, visit CapitalismRaceAndDemocracy.org. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer and J.R. Valray. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.